it does feel like we're at war. You know, I think there's this sort of element of people being worried, will this film start a race riot? You know, and will this start a war? Will this make temperatures even hotter?
Lena Waithe, the screenwriter of the new movie Queen and Slim, isn't looking to spark actual conflict, but she does want to shake people up. Then the National Enquirer documentary Scandalous shows how the supermarket tabloid got in bed with Donald Trump.
What's so interesting is you talk to these Enquirer guys who were sort of on Trump back in the 80s when he first came on the radar, and they would say, like, initially he wasn't Enquirer material.
And Washington lawmakers come to Hollywood to find out why Latinos aren't getting hired in film and television. It's the Frame Weekend from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. I'm John Horn. We'll be right back. Welcome to the Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. On this show, we talk with creative people about how and why they do what they do and about how their art is shaped by the wider world. Later, a new documentary about the National Enquirer and the rise of tabloid journalism in the eras of O.J. Simpson and Donald Trump. But we're going to start today with Queen and Slim. The movie had its premiere at the AFI Film Festival in L.A. this week. The movie stars Daniel Kaluuya from Get Out and newcomer Jodie Turner-Smith.
Are you going to ask me a question or not?
What took you so long to respond to me?
I didn't realize that much time had passed.
I sent you a very well-crafted message 3 weeks ago. I spell-checked it and everything, got crickets. Then today, out of the blue, you hit me up asking if you want to grab dinner. What changed?
Normally, I would go home and have a glass of wine by myself, but I didn't feel like being alone. Not tonight.
You didn't have any friends or family you can call?
No.
So you turned to Tinder.
They play a black couple who are driving home from an awkward first date when a white cop pulls them over. He quickly begins harassing them. The situation escalates, and the police officer is fatally shot. What follows is their escape on the road from Ohio toward Florida. The movie is written by Lena Waithe and directed by Melina Matsoukas, who's making her feature directing debut. They worked together on an Emmy-winning episode of Master of None, before making Queen and Slim. And is this the first thing that you guys have done together on
the
radio?
It's the first podcast.
Yeah, first podcast we've done. Yeah. Here. We've been doing some interviews together.
She's trying to convince me to do a show.
Yeah, we should.
Or at least a talking tour. And
something.
I'm like, please, no.
I like that idea.
Yeah. I like doing interviews with Melina.
It is fun. It makes it painless.
Yeah,
for me.
Yeah.
Who decided to set the story in Ohio?
Well, Lena had written that into the script because Ohio still has a death penalty.
Correct.
So obviously it was really important to Queen's character because she defends people on death row. But I had traveled to Ohio for a Nike commercial a couple of years before. And I had been to Cleveland. There was an area of Cleveland that's in a really black neighborhood. And I had shot, I still had the location pictures on my phone. On this one street called St. Clair. So I was really pushing to start there. I wanted to start in a really cold environment and have them travel south through the story. I always think of it as a reverse slave escape narrative where they're traveling south instead of north. And Cleveland was also the last stop on the Underground Railroad before slaves would get to Canada. So I thought that was really pertinent, like metaphorically for our film. And then also it's where Tamir Rice was killed, you know, where I got a chance to visit the playground where he was shot dead. And so I just felt like it was the right place for us. She wrote it in, and then, like, you know, visually I had been there. I had witnessed, like, how pertinent it was to us. And then when, you know, a lot of other people on our crew were really pushing for us to just stay in New Orleans because that's where we were already shooting, and obviously for budget reasons it's easier to just shoot in one place. But I wanted to travel with them, and I wanted them to feel that journey as actors and let that inform their performance. So we went up to Cleveland, and while we were scouting— we were on that street, St. Clair, and it was my director's scout, so we hadn't decided definitely to go there. But maybe in a half hour, like a Tuesday night, at least 6 black people were pulled over by cops in a half hour time period, and one of them was in a white Accord. And
that you are watching happen
as
in
we're
real
scouting.
Time.
We're scouting
she,
which
like,
block
me
we wanted to
picture.
Be on. Yeah.
Like, whoa.
And we had been staying in downtown Cleveland where there was no police presence. So this was like a trap in a black neighborhood to just like get people. Mm-hmm. And in a half hour, they were all pulled over and there was this one car, it was a Accord, and it was the Cleveland police car was behind him, pulled him over. And my production designer took a shot of it and I was like, that's Slim. That's Slim, that's his car, that's who he is. Like, he's every man and we have to be here.
I want to play some audio from a police stop. I think you're going to know what this is. This is Sandra Bland being pulled over in Texas.
You mind putting out your cigarette, please? Don't mind.
I'm in my car. Why do I have to put out my cigarette?
Well, you can step on out now.
I don't have to step out of my car.
Step out of the car. Step out of the car.
No, you don't have the right.
Step out of the car.
You do not have the right to do that.
I do have the right. Now step out or I will remove you.
I refuse to talk to you other than to identify myself.
Step out or I will remove you.
I am getting removed for a failure.
Step out or I will remove you. I'm giving you a lawful order. Get out of the car now.
And I should add, Sandra Bland died in police custody 3 days later. She was found hanged in her jail cell.
Right. And, you know, she was being picked on and prodded and harassed by a policeman that she pulled over to get out of his way, you know, and then he pulls her over for not using his signal.
Yeah, to me, it's just traumatizing. That's, you know, and I think people don't realize, for particularly black people, when these stories come across our news feeds, our televisions, our Instagram feeds, it's not just another story. It's not just a piece of news to us. It's like a piece of us dies every time we hear about a person being, particularly a black person, an unarmed black person being killed by a police officer. It's we are all living in a state of trauma. And I think that's where the movie was absolutely born out of for me.
Listening to that, we feel like we're hunted. You know, and I think that that's shown in just hearing those words. It's there's this war going on. And, you know, Lena called it the other day a genocide, which is exactly right.
I want to play another clip from the film. And this is, I think, kind of a moment of reckoning between Queen and Slim. I'm going to play it and then we'll talk about the look on Slim's face in this conversation.
Where are you going?
I'm going to find somebody with a phone so I can call my family.
If you do that, then they'll know where we are.
Great.
What if they kill us?
Don't say that.
There's no guarantee they won't.
You're a black man that killed a cop and then took his gun.
I'm not a criminal.
You are now.
You know, he feels the weight. He feels the gravity. He's starting to understand how he will be viewed, that he is now viewed as a monster, you know, when he was in the right, when he was just trying to defend himself and his woman in that moment. But I think, you know, his eyes, I think, in every scene, especially that one, they really transform, and the weight of what just happened is starting to land on him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think to me, the look that breaks my heart every time, I've seen the movie a lot, but it's just after that when he says, I just want to go home.
Yeah, he's pleading. He's just want to go home and I want to see my family.
And I think that it's interesting because I remember writing that, and as a person who is not super close to my family, but I was thinking, in that moment when you're afraid, all you want to do is get home to your family. And it's also, too, I think about Fruitvale Station, you know, and that moment where Michael B. Jordan says, I just want to go home. You know, that's what we all want. Mm-hmm. We all want to go home.
And it weighed on me because I am close to my family. Mm-hmm. So, like, in times of extreme need or terror or fear, that's where I want to go to the nest, right. You know, to my mom and my father,
right.
Who won't ever look at me as a criminal, you know. And I think he has that same satisfaction and that love in his home.
Right, right, right. Well, I think of you like family. You know what I'm saying? So, like, yes. Trying to get home to Melina.
So you're going to come home to me when you kill a cop in self-defense.
Yep, you will take care of me.
Hell yeah.
I know.
Melina, when you were thinking about casting this film, other than obviously wanting great actors, what was the look that you wanted? What were the kinds of people that you wanted to populate this film?
Well, when we started, Lena had already talked to Daniel. And she hadn't given him the role because she is respectful of me tremendously and would never give a role without, you know, making sure that I agree with it. So I met with him. And what should have been, you know, a 5-minute conversation turned into what hopefully will be a lifelong collaboration, mm-hmm. because he's an immense talent. And so we had Daniel, and it was important to both Lena and I that we use this opportunity to create a platform for a new Black actress, for a new voice, because we don't get many of those opportunities, and we knew we didn't want to waste it. So we wanted to find our queen. We wanted her to be introduce somebody new. And then we needed to have somebody that would stand up against Daniel. And then the other thing that was really important for us is that she was dark-skinned, that we could, I'd love to be a part of redefining what beauty is in the world. And we've never seen a love story between two dark-skinned actors on screen.
That the tendency is to get light-skinned actors, so they feel more white.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, in this country, obviously, there's a tendency that the lighter you are, the more Eurocentric looking you are, that's what's considered beautiful, right? Mm-hmm. And so many of our brothers and sisters don't grow up really having pride in themselves as dark-skinned beauties. And so that was really important. And then also to show the love, like, between those two people that could be dark-skinned and have that and represent it to the next generation, because that's not even something I grew up in with having.
Lena, I want to ask you about this balance in the film between brutality and beauty, because this is a story about something that is brutal that starts this couple on the road, and yet it's also a love story. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of beauty, not only in their relationship, but also in the people they meet along the way. Mm-hmm. When you're writing the story and trying to figure out the balance that you want to strike, what were the things that you were focused on?
A big thing was I wanted to focus on a sense of community. And it was a bit of a meditation on Underground Railroad for a modern age, in a way. And the fact that it does feel like we're at war. You know, I think there's this sort of element of people being worried, will this film start a race riot? You know, and will this start a war? Will this make temperatures even hotter? But the thing is, they said the same thing about Do the Right Thing. They said the same thing about Boys in the Hood. They said the same thing about New Jack City. Like, all these.
These are conversations while you're pitching this idea?
No, this was, I think, once we were done.
Okay.
You know, and
once people started to see the
film. Yes. Okay. And to me, it's like, when writing it, I'm very aware of that war that we're already in.
Because it's truth.
Yeah. And so it was almost about, what side are you on? And they never know, when they go out into the world or who they're encountering, if they're on their side, if they're not, you'd be surprised sometimes about who is on their side and who isn't. And there's so many influences that I have, whether, you know, I think people are quick to say Thelma and Louise and Bonnie and Clyde, which I understand, but also Wizard of Oz is in there. You know, it's also
The Wiz.
Set It Off. There's, you know, elements of Badlands. There's references that I think people don't expect me to have. But for me, the people they encounter, even though these are somewhat small roles, I wanted every role to feel gigantic.
At one point in the movie, Queen and Slim are called Bonnie and Clyde. There have been other references to Bonnie and Clyde, and talking about this film, it seems misplaced because Bonnie and Clyde chose to be the people they are. Queen and Slim were victims of history.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they don't want to be heroes. They don't consider themselves heroes. When you're talking with Melina, Lena, when you're talking with the actors, what were the conversations you had about heroism and about being thrust into a story that you don't want to be a part of?
I think early on, I think I said this to Melina, is that regular people like Emmett Till, like Trayvon Martin, like Mike Brown, like Eric Garner, can quickly become symbols of a movement. And they can also ignite a movement. And that was not their choice. You know, we know their names, we know their story because they were killed, not because of what they contributed to our society. And I knew, and even like talking to Melina, we talked about this, is that Black life is not as celebrated as Black death. And that is something that I wrestle with, I meditate on, obviously, and I was doing that in writing the script. And so for me, it was really about Black people creating the heroes in which they need. And I think at some point we may need to stop doing that because we have to be our own heroes in our lives. But it's easier to follow than to lead.
Lena and Lena, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much. That was amazing.
Lena Waithe is the screenwriter of Queen and Slim. Melina Matsoukas directed the film. It opens in theaters on November 27th. This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn.
Everybody's got opinions on nothing. Say we're flying down a path with no ending. And if I die before I wake, ooh, don't let me wake, come from
in the constant day. Conversation about who gets included in Hollywood and who doesn't, Latinos continue to be woefully underrepresented. Now some Washington lawmakers are getting involved. Last week, members of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus came to Los Angeles to meet with leaders in the entertainment business to find out what's going on. Congressman Joaquin Castro of San Antonio is the committee chair.
We went to Los Angeles on two issues in particular. The first one is diversity in Hollywood and the gross underrepresentation of Latinos in the entertainment industry. And the second is portrayal of Latinos in television and film. For example, this latest Annenberg report found that of the Latino lead characters on film, 28% played criminals, which is obviously for any American community or segment of society, a misrepresentation. And so we had meetings with six or seven studios and executives from those studios. We met with a few of the guilds, the Screen Actors Guild, SAG-AFTRA, and the Directors Guild. And we had a chance to meet with about 40 Latino actors, actresses, producers, directors, and others about the Hollywood ecosystem and the challenges that they face getting work in that system.
It's not just the kinds of parts that Latinos are getting, it's the number of parts. Latino actors barely got 4.5% of the more than 47,000 speaking roles in the top 100 grossing movies from each of the past 12 years. And Latinos make up a huge percentage, not only of the U.S. population, but also of the movie-going public. It's almost a quarter of all ticket buyers are Latinos.
Right.
So was there any explanation about that disconnect? There's a huge audience, there's a huge segment of the population, but when it comes to actually getting the parts, the Latino population is almost invisible.
I can't say that there was a satisfactory answer to that issue. They did talk about their different pipelines for writing, for directing, for this and that, that they're working on. But as I said to those folks in the meetings, look, if you're at 3% now of Latinos in front of the camera and behind the camera, then whatever you've been doing in the past obviously has not worked. So what are you doing right now and what do you plan to do to improve those numbers? And it's very strange that an industry like Hollywood that's considered liberal and progressive, that it would have worse numbers than the fossil fuel industry, the oil and gas industry in my home state of Texas.
The numbers obviously don't lie. The representation of Latinos, along with a lot of underrepresented groups in Hollywood, is terrible. Why is it important that it change, and why is it important to you personally?
Well, there is a cost to that underrepresentation in C-suites, in terms of casting directors, producers, etc. And part of that cost is a misportrayal of Latinos. I think it not only affects how people see themselves, but also how the larger American public sees the Latino community. So when a president or a politician or anyone else gets up and says that Latinos are criminals and rapists or murderers, and then people turn on their television set and they go to a movie and that's exactly what they see, then it affirms that idea for them that the person who's speaking is right. And taken to its extreme, it leads to what you got in El Paso, Texas a few months ago, which is a madman driving 10 hours to kill 21 people because he sees Hispanics as invaders to the United States. Never mind that Latinos have been here for generations. And so Hollywood has to take a really deep and close look in the mirror and start to change, and change sincerely, not just by lip service, but actually change.
Let's assume that these Hollywood executives who aren't really doing what maybe they should be doing were to testify in front of Congress. What would you ask them?
Congress has brought different industries in front of it to question them on their practices in terms of hiring and diversity and what commitment they're making to those things. And so I would ask them questions about the processes they put in place. I mean, look, when you're in a city that is 40% Latino, in a state that's 40% Latino, a country that's 18%, movie ticket buyers that are 23% over-indexed on movie ticket sales, and this group of people only has about 3% of the roles when you combine in front of and behind the camera, you get to a point where you have to admit that that's systemic exclusion of a group of people. And when we have systemic problems, not just individual problems or one person here or there, when you have systemic problems, those are the kinds of things that Congress and legislatures should get involved with.
Joaquin Castro represents San Antonio in the U.S. House of Representatives. He also chairs the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. Congressman, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
After a short break, a fading American car company takes on an Italian racing legend. Ford versus Ferrari. It's next on The Frame Weekend. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Filmmaker James Mangold has a knack for telling true stories about creative partnerships. He did it with Reese Witherspoon and Joaquin Phoenix in the 2005 movie about Johnny and June Carter Cash. And he's done it again with his new film, Ford versus Ferrari.
How long have we known each other, Ken? I ever break a promise to you? I will put you in the driver's seat at Le Mans. You just shut your mouth and let me do my thing.
In the film, race car designer Carroll Shelby, who's played by Matt Damon, teams up with British driving legend Ken Miles, who's played by Christian Bale. In 1965, they built and raced the Ford GT.
Where are we, James? I want you to describe the
scene. We're in a meadow looking at some
The movie had its world premiere at the Telluride Film Festival, and director James Mangold was there.
The really interesting story about Carroll Shelby's younger years, and that's who Matt Damon plays in the movie, is that he had a heart condition and didn't know it, and in the height of his racing career was alerted that if he ever raced again, he'd die. So he had to quit racing. And so all that ambition and drive and risk-seeking all had to get pushed into design and salesmanship. And so in many ways, his relationship with Christian's character, Ken Miles, Ken, it becomes a kind of surrogate for him.
You can stick this bloody sticker where the sun...
Hey, Bill. Hey, right. Bill, what seems to be the problem, Bill?
Well, the problem is that Bill here is an asshole.
No, he doesn't mean that.
No, yes, he does.
No,
yes, he
really
does. Yes, no,
that.
He
He's
really does
you,
think
Bill.
That
He's
Bill is a
Bill,
let me
I'm just doing my job
Bill,
here.
Bill, in my experience, there is, listen to me, something like this, there's always a middle ground. Mm-hmm. All right, now Ken's out of line.
And I'm just doing my job.
I understand you are. You know how he gets on a race day.
You know that, all right, but you're not going to DQ us over a trunk.
But you do something with the racing, you and your cinematographer, Finn Papamichael, and that is you shoot the races from the racer's perspective. We don't have these overhead shots of hundreds of cars. You are taking the viewer into the car so that he or she is in with your racer, Ken Miles.
Absolutely, John. I think that the whole, I mean, the to me, the on a sheer ego level, if I'm going to make a sports movie and my shooting style of the sport is going to look the same as what you'd see on your weekend sports broadcast, then I've kind of, it may just be my own sense of pride, but I feel like I've failed. But secondly, the movie was about these guys and these guys pushing these cars to their limit, but also subtleties. You know, Ken Miles was a great racer and a great engineer, but his greatest competition was with himself. And I think we make that pretty clear in the movie. You know, he was trying to top himself. He didn't care about the marketing. He didn't care about the rankings. He didn't care about fame. He just had a goal of being as good as he could be and better than he was yesterday. And that, even saying that, how could I ever show anything like that if I'm not in that cab with him?
We're talking with James Mangold about his new movie, Ford v. Ferrari. You cast Tracy Letts as Henry Ford II, and there's a scene that I will just say where Henry Ford II is in a car going very fast.
You ready?
I was born ready, Mr. Shelby. Hit it.
Oh,
And I'm watching that scene, and I'm not sure if I'm watching Henry Ford II in a car or Tracy Letts in a car, because it feels like what is happening in real time, and the actor and the character are both panicked by what is happening.
Well, I don't know that Tracy was really panicked, but I will say that Tracy was using what we were giving him, and he did play the scene. We took him for Mr. Toad's Wild Ride in that car, and kept the camera running after it stopped.
Let me ask you this last question. You teach film, and is there a scene that you would teach out of Ford versus Ferrari that might have been a really difficult scene to pull off that you think you could talk about in a classroom? And what would that talk be about, and what scene would you pick?
Well, usually when I do a class, I'll actually pick a fairly simple scene. That as directors, it's not always the stuff that everyone notices with the flying camera flying through the window or through a keyhole that is filmmaking. It's actually, how do you handle a kitchen scene? Or how do you handle, you know, one of my favorite scenes in the picture. It's very simple. It's just Christian and Matt in a Mexican diner. But it's like, for me, what I treasure and what I value is how well a director does those simple things. You know, one of the things I think Steven Spielberg never gets acknowledgement for, because his movies are so spectacle oriented usually, is that no one's better at moving the actors around. Just a simple scene of Indy Jones packing before he goes off across the Atlantic is a tapestry of blocking, crosses, move closer to camera, away from camera. That's what I try and focus on, is how much you can do with how little.
James, thanks so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure, man. Good to be here.
James Mangold is the director of Ford versus Ferrari. It has just opened in theaters. I'm John Horn, and you're listening to The Frame Weekend.
The ultimate mission: sell the most papers of anybody in the world.
I don't think any of us realize what was to come.
Scandal is an engine that powers the National Enquirer, so it's only natural that filmmaker Mark Lanzmann would title his documentary about the supermarket tabloid Scandalous. Using archival tape and new interviews, he tracks key moments when the paper affected our culture, from how we cover news to who we put in the White House.
What's so interesting is you talk to these Inquirer guys who were sort of on Trump back in the 80s when he first came on the radar. And they would say, like, initially, he wasn't Inquirer material. He wasn't sort of big enough for us. We thought he was a New York real estate guy who just was very sort of provincial and regional to New York. And it was only after Marla Maples, which, you know, seems like a very well orchestrated stunt if you look at it. You know, I'm not suggesting that it was, but it's almost too bizarre to show up with your mistress and your wife on ski slopes in Colorado
together
in a photo and have a photo op. You know, it's just, it was all ridiculous. And I think that was at this point, there was a little bit of an epiphany among Inquirer leadership saying, oh, this guy actually could sell papers. And I think with Trump, there was a recognition, like, you know, here's this paper that, you know, reaches tens of millions of Americans a week. You know, they said that for every one person that bought an Inquirer, three read it. So, I mean, that's an unbelievable amount of eyeballs.
And even if people didn't read it, they saw the headlines while they're buying their groceries.
Precisely. So he kind of grew up through the paper in terms of his image in popular American culture. And of course, that obviously translates into The Apprentice and everything that would follow. But the Inquirer is really where it began. And I think he saw, as is stated in the film, that the Inquirer could give him a mouthpiece, could help him amplify, could help him reach a population that would never have given him second thought.
Well, in fact, there's audio of Donald Trump pretending to be Donald Trump's publicist, pitching stories about his client, who is himself.
He would call the tabloids in New York to drop gossip items about himself.
I've never seen anybody get so many calls from the press.
Where did you come from?
I work for a couple of different firms, and I'm somebody that knows.
Right. Okay.
He's had pseudonyms where he'd call and pretend that he was a spokesperson.
What's your name again?
John Miller.
And you work with Donald?
Yes, that's correct.
He really wanted to be a star.
We're talking with Mark Landsman about his documentary, Scandalous. There's also a large part of your documentary that focuses on the actual journalism that is done at the National Enquirer. And it sounds oxymoronic, but in some ways, even though the Enquirer does things that reputable journalists don't do, which is essentially pay for information, they do break a lot of stories. I want to play a clip about a certain criminal trial in Los Angeles.
Enquirer editors say they have been following abuse allegations against the former football superstar since 1989.
When the Simpson murders occurred, we knew this was a seminal moment for the National Enquirer. We already had huge networks in place in the celebrity community, and this occurred in the middle of one of our networks.
Unlike the mainstream outlets like the LA Times, the New York Times, Washington Post, Globe, etc., you know, who had maybe one or two reporters on this case, the Enquirer had 20. This literally fell into their laps. As he says, it was in the middle of our source network. You have to remember that the Enquirer had been establishing a spy network in Los Angeles since the early 70s.
Just to cover celebrities.
Just to cover celebrities, but it was very, and you know, and O.J. Simpson was a huge celebrity. So they had already had moles in the OJ camp all over the place. And so when this thing hit, they were ready. They were also, remarkably, one of the only publications to actually have the courage to cover Nicole Brown's abuse.
Long history of abuse.
You didn't see articles like that in other publications because people weren't writing about domestic abuse that way. The Enquirer took that on. You know, I'm not waving the flag for them, but this is just why they were so situated. They had gained the trust of the Brown and the Goldman family. They were inside that family. They knew people in the prosecutor's office. They were on the plane with Marcia Clark. You know, they were everywhere, literally everywhere, and they just couldn't be beat. So, you know, when a lot of the mainstream press was looking one way, the Enquirer was looking always.
Something else happens during the O.J. Simpson trial, which I think is critical to understanding the history of the National Enquirer. And that is that the information that the Enquirer was reporting starts to appear in publications like the New York Times. And against that backdrop, it's also important to remember that the three major networks devoted more time to covering O.J. Simpson than they did the Oklahoma City bombing and the Bosnian War combined. So this celebrity trial, I think, is a tipping point in the tabloidization of the news media. Do you buy that argument?
I absolutely do buy it. I mean, and so do you. You know, people like Carl Bernstein and really, you know, people who study media buy it. I mean, it's exactly what happened. I think this is the point when the fabric really starts to fray and people in the mainstream start to, you know, give kudos to a paper that they wouldn't line their kitty litter with. And all of a sudden you have somebody like David Margolick in the New York Times saying that the headline said Enquirer required reading in the Simpson case. I mean, that was astonishing to people at the time. And you have people like Carl Bernstein and others sort of, you know, sounding the clarion bell. You know, okay, we should be concerned about this, folks, because something has tipped. And I think, look, there's always been sensationalism in journalism since the dawn of time. I mean, I think people really like to think of it as a black and white thing that, the mainstream publications don't do this, but that's not true.
True. William Randolph Hearst was doing it from
Randolph
the beginning.
Randolph Hearst and Joseph Pulitzer did it, and people did it before they did. This is really sort of one of the core questions we wanted to explore in the film is, you know, how did this all happen? How did we get here? You know, how did we get to a place where, as is said in the film, we can't have a civil debate about what is a fact. We can't have consensus on what is a fact anymore. That's a frightening thing. You know, I mean, as a parent of a young child growing up in this media saturated culture, I'm concerned about that. You know, that we are having public figures mess with facts, and we're having journalists spend all of their precious time trying to substantiate facts. And then you have the fact that facts no longer matter because you're just subscribing to whatever it is you want to hear. We're in echo chambers, as Brooke Gladstone likes to say. So, you know, it's a very freaky time.
Mark Landsman is the director of Scandalous. Mark, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, John. It's a pleasure.
Scandalous, the true story of the National Enquirer, is in select theaters now. Coming up after a short break, Tony-winning actor Beatty Wong directs a new play about basketball and China.
Play's fundamental question for me is the question of whether or not you will choose to be a person who makes movement, and there's a basketball metaphor here, or one whether you will choose to be still.
BD Wong directing The Great Leap. That's next on The Frame Weekend. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Tony Witter, BD Wong, is known for parts on Broadway, television, and movies, but recently he's taken on the role of theater director.
Yeah, I started out as a director when I was in high school. I had a wonderful mentorial relationship with a drama teacher who encouraged me to not squander my potential, and part of the potential that she saw was my potential as a director.
Wong is currently directing The Great Leap at the Pasadena Playhouse. It's centered on an actual basketball game between the United States and China in 1989, at the same time that the Tiananmen Square protest was happening.
Lauren Yee, the playwright, is enjoying great popularity with her with all of her plays, but the two in particular are in the top three plays that are being produced this year.
Great Leap
Cambodian Rock Band, yeah.
The news has almost eclipsed this play in terms of what's going on in China, not just in relation to Hong Kong, but with basketball. I mean, it feels like the headlines that are being written about conversations about sport and China and protest couldn't make this play more timely.
That's absolutely true. And it's very exciting when that happens. And you feel like you've kind of hit the jackpot because you are doing something that is on the forefront of people's minds. The comparison, of course, between what's going on over there and the play itself is really relegated to politics and basketball and China. But those are three things that don't really you say in the same sentence all the time. So I don't know why I'm complaining. But it is just that it's not really like the play itself is going to illuminate anything that's actually in the news. But it is amazing that we're talking about basketball in China and Hong Kong and all that, and protests and stuff.
No, the play is about identity. I think that's what you would have to say. It's ultimately about finding your place and about family and how all those things are so interconnected. Even though basketball and China is part of the story, that doesn't feel like what it's about.
Oh, yeah, that's the backdrop and the setting for it. But the play is also about the idea of your own life path and how you choose to live it, and whether you choose to be a leader or a follower, or whether you choose to make waves or not.
If you were pitching Great Leap to an audience member, mm-hmm. how would you describe what you want the play to do in terms of how they see the world or see themselves in it?
I'd say that I think the play, you know, at this time in our lives, as an American, really, as there's a lot of kind of political turmoil with our leaders and the kind of mess of the current administration. And that frustration creates a question in our minds about what it is that is our own responsibility, what it is that we choose to do, and whether we choose to step forward or not. And the play's fundamental question for me is the question of whether or not you will choose to be a person who makes movement, and there's a basketball metaphor here in there in the play, or one whether you will choose to be still. And that is a powerful question that you walk away from this play asking yourself, which character are you? Are you the one who moves, or are you the one who stands still? And I have to say that we all, and this audience, thinks it is the person that moves always. We always think we are that person. But when we really ask ourselves, we have to ask ourselves, at what level are we really that person? What is our, what in our lives and in our actions really show that we are that person? And to see the two characters in great relief in the same play who are struggling with the issue of that creates that question for us. So that's what I want them to walk away with, asking themselves that question.
We're talking with actor and director BD Wong. You played one of the main characters, Wan Chong, who is the coach of the Beijing University team in two previous productions.
Yes.
When you step out of playing a character and are directing that character, what is that transformation like in terms of your perspective on the role and the overall production?
This is super interesting because, yeah, you know, it's a completely different point of view. You have a much more global view of the play, the production, and the other actors. And so for me, my intimacy with the character plays a role in my relationship with the actor playing the role that I once played, because I have a kind of shorthand with the part that allows me to kind of cut through some things that I have to be very careful about cutting through, because an actor should have his own process and find something out in his own time and in his own rhythm. But sometimes I can have insight into a moment. For example, one of the things that actors do in a play like Lauren's, which is written with a great deal of humor, is to try to find where the humor for that particular actor is. But I can also say, hey, you know what? I know for a fact this is actually really funny, so you should just, like, go for it.
But you have to be careful that you don't say, this is how I would have played it.
Oh, yeah, but I would never. If someone's actually says those words, which I think is something you'd see in a movie or something like that, that just, I bristle at the idea of it.
Even though this is a international and national story, it feels like there is so much of San Francisco and the city in this story.
Yeah.
What is it about San Francisco and about these characters' lives that you think is so important to reflect in terms of the Bay Area and what that city is like and what these characters' lives are like in that city?
Well, I think it's really wonderful when a playwright uses a specific time or place and explores the universality of her characters through that specific time or place. So when she describes these things, it strikes a chord for us who know the place, but it also strikes a chord because of its authenticity to anyone who doesn't know the place, because, as it turns out, Lauren herself is from the Bay Area. And that's one of my touchstones with her, is that we're San Francisco Chinese Americans, and the San Francisco Chinese American vibe is very prevalent in this play. And so I feel a sense of a kind of understanding her in that way. And I love working on the play because of that. I always have, from the beginning as an actor, but now as a director, kind of trying to imbue in whatever way possible my point of view as a person from San Francisco and a Chinese American. That's one of the more fun aspects of doing this particular directing job for me.
The Pasadena Playhouse, like a lot of big arts institutions in and around L.A., has a core audience. That core audience, because I've been to a lot of plays there, is older and it's white. Mm-hmm. This is a play about a Chinese-American experience. So how do you make sure that you are authentic to a new audience, Chinese-Americans who are coming to the Playhouse, and also give what I'll call the older white audience a perspective into a story that they may not have access to any other way?
Well, it's humanity, you know. It's like illuminating humanity for a person of any color or any age is undeniable. And when you strike a chord emotionally or with humor, and Lauren does both of these in her writing very deftly, then you can reach anybody. I will also say, Lauren Yee is a bit of a kind of gateway playwright. She really can draw people into a seemingly specific storyline, location, and culture, and open it up through, like I said before, humor and emotion to make it seem completely universal. I mean, universal is a kind of a buzzword that people like to use, but it really is true that people can relate to the play because they're simply human beings and they have feelings and aspirations and dreams and disappointments, just like the characters in this play, regardless of their race or their age.
B.D. Wong, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
B.D. Wong is the director of The Great Leap. It's up now at the Pasadena Playhouse. The Walt Disney Company launched its streaming service Disney Plus this week with tons of content, but there are some other recent entries in the streaming wars, like Apple TV Plus. It has just a few shows, including Dickinson. It stars Haley Steinfeld as the poet Emily Dickinson, and even though it's a period story, the series has modern music. Its composers are a married couple. His name is Ian Holtquist, and her name, at least when it comes to writing music, is Drum and Lace.
We did something so strange and so out there, and they were like, oh, we love it. And we're like, okay, I think this is going to be fun.
Yeah, we thought those main titles would be the first and last thing that we did on the show. Hi, my name is Ian Holtquist, and I'm a film composer.
I'm Drum and Lace, but you can call me Sophia, and I'm also a composer and a performer.
It was pretty random. Like, we had no idea what was coming in, and we just got a call from Apple, I think November of last year, saying that there's this new strange show about Emily Dickinson, but with kind of like a modern synth score.
And I think at first we kind of thought that they might have been pulling our leg because we were like, yes, hello, this is Apple, you know, like what? But turns out that I guess they really liked what they'd heard and thought that we would be good for the show because of our different sensibilities.
It was exciting. It was maybe a little intimidating just because a lot of the stuff that they were putting in as temp music or as like their inspiration is like really well-known pop music that's out now.
And produced by like three Swedish people yeah. in like months of time and thousands of dollars, you know, and we're like, how are we going to compete with this?
Yeah, so it was, you know, it was kind of a tall order to have a score that can compete with tracks like that, but then also live in Emily's world and be cinematic and like kind of carry all these different weights at the same time.
I'm madly in love with you.
Too bad.
Is there someone else?
Yes. Actually.
Who is he? I'll kill him.
You can't kill him. He is death.
What?
I'm in love with death.
We can see some of the statistics of people listening, and actually there's one of the themes that's the death theme. And we keep seeing that that's the most Shazammed, and it's such a compliment because I think people think it's an actual hip-hop track, and then they find out it's us, and I love that. I wonder what people's reaction is to that.
One thing that we've kind of played around a bit on other projects, but it's never really been at the forefront, was using Sophia's voice as an actual instrument. You know, as like a different texture, just to kind of make it sound more interesting. And as soon as they heard it, they were like, wait a second, that's amazing. And now it's become like the biggest note we keep getting is like more Sophie vocals, more Sophie vocals. Her singing voice has really kind of become like the inner thoughts of Emily in a way.
I didn't really think about the fact that there could be this like further connection between the vocals and, you know, the way that she's feeling internally. And, you know, and voice is kind of something that's been used to express oneself since the beginning of time. And I feel like especially there's one, episode 9 has one called The Hour of Death, which is interesting because it starts off with being kind of within a setting where you would hear a vocal piece because they're in a church. But then by the end of it, she has an encounter, one of the many encounters with death, and it becomes like her eulogy in a way.
I felt a funeral in my brain and mourners to and fro.
I feel like we've worked together enough at this point where we've become really good at being critics to ourselves and trusting each other. So if someone says something's not working, we usually trust that. You know, I think at least once every project, there's always a bit of an explosion and maybe a door gets slammed or something.
But on the flip side, it also, I think that there's been times when if Ian started a cue and he's like, no, this is garbage, like, let's start from scratch, I'll go in and I'll be like, no, we can salvage this. And then yeah. It transforms into just something different. And that's why it's nice to have the two of us, because it's like something that Ian or that I would have thought was a complete disaster at the beginning can evolve into something that actually works. We work at home studios, so we're literally in the same room for every single cue and every single moment, sitting at the same desk, and
we end up spending a lot of hours in the studio together.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been trying to get on almost like a 9-to-5 schedule lately, but it's just, you know, in this crazy world of scoring, like, it just, you might get an email full of 2 pages of notes at 10 p.m. that are due the next morning by brunch or whatever, so you just don't really have a choice.
You mean like what happened last night?
Yes, exactly.
There's a lot that I think needs to get caught up on, especially in the age of streaming, especially when it comes to the fact that it's so hard for us to release soundtracks as composers, and, you know, like, even in terms of, you know, royalties and...
There's a lot of questions in the air that are talked about. Every new project, it's like, so how are the rights going to work on this one?
Because I think once upon a time, people would be like, okay, well, the royalties are, you know, at least, like, for us, it's like, we kind of talk about this all the time, like, oh, to have been a TV composer in the 90s, you know, because you... see all these like TV composers from the 80s and 90s, and it's like, welcome to my Malibu home with my like two studios. And meanwhile, it's like, I'm just excited that I get to make a live, like any kind of living doing this. But at the same time, it's like the same way that it is with Spotify and Apple Music and with all of these kind of like streaming platforms, is that people just expect for things to be free. So when people expect for things to be free, and when music is something that's so abstract, it's really hard to put a price point on it. Because, you know, if you're buying a painting, you're like, okay, well, I can see the materials. And whereas with us, it's like, it's all just time. And how do you quantify time?
Dickinson is on Apple TV Plus now. The Frame Weekend is edited by Darby Maloney and produced by Herb, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, Julia Paskin, and Emily Henderson. Eduardo Perez is our engineer. Andrea Gutierrez is our news clerk. Our intern is Paul Ratliff. The Frame's opening theme music is by Taylor McFerrin, and the show's senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. Have a great weekend. We'll be back here on Monday for the daily version of The Frame. We'll see you then.